Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Hazen Jihu. It is my pleasure to introduce Robert Rice, Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at UC Berkeley and best-selling author of Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not Just the Few. Professor Rice served in three national administrations and was the Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. He serves as the Chair of Common Sense and Senior Fellow at the Bloom Center for Developing Economies. He is also the co-founder editor of the American Prospect magazine and is a frequent guest on NPR's Marketplace. In 2003, Robert was awarded the prestigious Vaclav Havel Vision Foundation Prize for his pioneering work in economic and social thought. In 2008, Time magazine named him one of the 10 most affected cabinet secretaries of the 20th century, and Wall Street Journal placed him sixth on the list of the most influential business thinkers. His film, Inequality for All, won the U.S. Documentary Special Jury Award for Achievement in Filmmaking at the 2013 Sundance Film Festival. Professor Rice graduated with honors from Dartmouth College and received his law degree from Yale Law School. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Robert Rice.
Hazen, thank you. Well, thank you, Hazen. And thank all of you. As you can see, the economy has worn me down. Really, before the Great Recession, I was, I was 6 foot two, and it's just, it's great to see all of you tonight. And what we're going to do, I'm going to summarize my entire book and my life's work in 20 minutes, and then Judge Cordell is going to come up and ask me some questions, and then you are going to participate in questions, and we promise to get you out of here in an hour. Oh, but then you're going to buy my book, and I'm going to sign it for you. I've been on a book tour, and I just came back from 3 weeks in the Midwest, mostly in red states, in red cities. And you might say to yourself, well, now, why was that? Why did he do that? And I did it because I tell my students every year at Berkeley, any Cal grads here? Go Bears. I tell my students every year at Berkeley that the best way to learn is to talk to somebody who disagrees with you. And all of us are too often in our bubbles, and we don't really talk to people who disagree with us. And so I thought the best way of learning for me would to turn my book tour into a little bit of a tour through red city, red state America. And it was interesting. For one thing, nobody liked the title of my new book, which is Saving Capitalism. Because they were kind of annoyed. They said, it sounds like you're being critical. What's wrong with capitalism? It's interesting because I got back to Berkeley just a few days ago and nobody liked the title of my book. Because they said, why do you want to save it? So it's a title that works nowhere, completely antagonizes everybody. But I think realistically, and what I have said on this book tour to audiences in the heartland is pretty much what I'll say to you tonight, and that is that realistically we have to understand that capitalism is not working as it might work to improve the well-being of most people. Some people in this audience, judging from your looks and also the color of your hair, remember a time in American history that I remember, and that is the first 30 years after the Second World War. We had a very different economy in those years, an economy in which as productivity improved and as the economy grew, everybody, just about everybody's income increased in tandem with the growth of the economy, even the bottom 20%. In fact, between 1946 and 1980, if you were in the bottom fifth, bottom 20% by income, your income increased on average faster than the people in the top 20%. So we were actually moving toward a greater, more egalitarian, more inclusive society. Now, obviously, we're not going to, nobody wants, and it would be inappropriate, it would be inefficient to have complete equality, because if you have complete equality, where do you get incentives to invent and innovate? That's not the issue. The issue really is, do you have a society and an economy in which everybody has an equal opportunity to succeed, and in which the fruits of economic prosperity are as widely shared as possible? And we were doing that in the first three decades after the Second World War. We did it partly because we invested like mad in education and in infrastructure. You remember in California, now I'm a relative newcomer to California, I got out here 10 years ago, but California had a reputation of being the best in terms of K-12 education. The University of California system was the crown jewel, the shining light, but the entire California system of public education was the envy of not only the country, but the world. Well, we can get into what's happened since, but it was also investments in infrastructure, in everything from freeways to in the environment to energy to pipes and water systems. I mean, the infrastructure investments we made were extraordinary. And we also, at the same time, paid for a lot of this through our taxes. And taxes, nobody really complained about. Well, everybody always complains about taxes, but I mean, it wasn't as if we felt terribly oppressed, although the top tax rate, the top marginal tax rate, was never between 1940, the end of the war, let's say 1946 to 1980, was never below 70%, the top marginal tax rate. And under Dwight Eisenhower, who, remember, was a Republican, the top marginal tax rate got to be 91%. Now, the effective rate, now again, we're talking about top marginal tax rate, and I don't want to get lost in the weeds here, but the effective rate was below that, but it was still the top effective rate after all the deductions, after all the tax credits, was still quite significantly above 50%. And then we also had so many people who were becoming more prosperous that you had their taxes as well. So you didn't have run big budget deficits. We had a lot of public investment. It was paid for. We also, at the same time, had an economy that was very innovative. We did not have Wall Street, by the way. Finance was not nearly as large a part of the economy in those years. In fact, finance was pretty boring. Nobody I knew went into, I don't want to insult anybody here. If you're from finance, that's great. I admire you, and you're great. But I just want to say that the finance was pretty boring in those years, and people, you know, did not necessarily aspire to go to Wall Street or to go into finance. They wanted to do other things. And the National Defense Highway Act, the National Defense Education Act, we actually justified a lot of our public investments in terms of competition with the Soviet Union. Well, we don't have the Soviet Union any longer. But after 1980, 1981, 82, something profoundly changed. No longer did the median wage or the wages of most people continue to go up with overall growth and innovation and productivity gains. No, in fact, the median wage started to stagnate. Adjusted for inflation, the median wage went nowhere. Now, average wages went up, and this is some confusion that some people have. When I say average and median, they mean different things. Average wage went up, median wage flattened out. I mean, the best example I know to give you is that Shaquille O'Neal, the basketball player, and I have an average height of 6'1". Now, Because, you know, see, the average, that I mean, I use that example because the average pulls up it gives you an artificial view of what's really happened. It doesn't tell you what's happened to the little guy. And that's why the median is a better measure. And beginning in 1980, 81, 82, the median wage really started to stagnate, even though the economy kept on growing, even though productivity kept on growing. We stopped investing quite as much as a percentage of GDP, the total economy, in education or in infrastructure. We had major tax cuts. We can debate whether those were good or bad. The day before yesterday, I had a big public debate with a dear friend of mine named Arthur Laffer. Some of you know Art Laffer. He's wrong about everything, but he's not here to defend himself. But he would disagree with my assessment. But he doesn't disagree with the facts, and that is the fact is the marginal tax rate plummeted. We had tax revolts around the country, including California. I think some of those tax revolts, by the way, were partly a reflection of the fact that the median wage was just beginning to flatten out at the end of the 70s, and a lot of people said, particularly working class, middle class people, they said, well, we can't afford to pay taxes, those kinds of taxes, and it's understandable. But as a result of this great U-turn, and it really was a great U-turn that happened at the late 70s, early 1980s, the country began to look different. And I was a professor, I was in government and out of government, and I started to look at the data, even when I was Secretary of Labor for Bill Clinton, and it looked very odd. This gap between productivity gains on the one hand and where the median wage was. By the way, if the economy is almost twice as large as it was in 1980 now, and the median wage is flat and continues to be relatively flat, adjusted for inflation, where did all the money go? Class. Now here's where we get into a delicate subject. Because I have been accused of being a class warrior. I am not a class warrior. I'm a class worrier. Do you see there's a subtle difference? I worry, and what I worry about is as we get to a greater and greater, greater degree of economic inequality, more and more income and wealth concentration at the top, stagnant wages, and then we have at the bottom, we have as much percentage of poverty as we've ever had. We've got about 20% of all of the children in the United States are impoverished. But as we head in more and more in that direction, what I worry about are a couple of things. Number one, I worry about the economy overall. Because without a large and growing and buoyant middle class, you don't have enough purchasing power to keep the economy going. This was a very anemic recovery. For those of you who paid a lot of attention to the recovery, it really wasn't much to write home about. Most Americans do not believe that they were affected by the recovery. And it was an anemic recovery because there wasn't very much purchasing power to keep the economy robust and going because there wasn't that much money in the middle class and the poor. I was visited, by the way, recently by the CEO of a big high-tech company that I shall not give him away or it away, but it's very big. Big. Not too far from here. Big. And he wanted to talk about inequality, and we talked about for a couple of hours, and I finally said, well, why are you interested in this subject? And he said, because, frankly, I'm concerned about my customer base. I'm worried that if we continue in the direction we're going, who's going to, you know, years from now, I may not have the customers that we're counting on. Now, why the big U-turn? Well, part of it has to do with a word that has gone from obscurity to meaninglessness without any intervening period of coherence, and that is globalization. And we can talk about that. But another second reason has to do with technological displacement. And I think that's what the fellow who visited me was most concerned about, because he said, look, we're going to be displacing more and more and more jobs, and that means people are not going to either have jobs or they're going to be falling into the local service sector of the economy, retail and restaurant and hotel and hospital and surface transportation and child care and elder care, and they're just not going to make much money. But either way, who's going to buy? Who's going to be left in terms of technological change? So those are two big factors responsible for the U-turn, but there is a third factor that I talk about a lot in my latest book, and I don't want to be talking too much about it tonight because I don't want to give away the plot. But I'll just give you a hint. And that is a political factor, and that is that as more and more income and wealth gets concentrated at the top, and this is not critical, I'm not being critical of anybody, but what happens, and it happened in the 1920s, it happened in the 1890s, it happened in the 1830s, what happens is when every time you get a lot of income and wealth concentrated at the top, you get a lot of political power at the top as well. Because income, wealth, and political power all tend to go together. It's not that anybody is behaving badly, it's just that given the structure of a political economy, income, wealth, and power go together. The great jurist, Louis Brandeis, once wrote, in the 1920s, he wrote, America has a choice. We can have great wealth in the hands of a few, or we can have a democracy, but we can't have both. And we all know exactly what he means because we're now living through that. The New York Times, about 3 weeks ago, had a piece, I don't know how many of you saw it, where 158 people, their families and their businesses, were responsible for a half of all of the campaign contributions to date in leading up to the 2016 election. 158 people, their families and businesses. Well, that kind of political influence has a compounding effect. Historically, it has a compounding effect because what happens is, and it's that when you have that much influence, you tilt the playing field slightly. The rules and laws that shape the market become tilted slightly in the direction of what very big corporations and big banks and some wealthy people want. And that compounds itself because then if it's tilted in their direction, they get even more, and then they have more political power, and then what happens? You get periods of time, and we've had already in this country three periods of time where you get these kinds of populist uprisings. People are so angry, they are so frustrated, they've so had it, that what happens is you get this anti-establishment surge. Now this time it's called Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, Ben Carson. I don't care who they are. We've had it before in America. And I'm not saying it's good or bad, it just is real. The anger out there cannot be disguised any longer. All the way through the last 3 weeks when I'm in the Midwest and I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I'm in St. Louis and Cincinnati and Kansas City and Missouri, all the way, and Iowa and Iowa City and Des Moines, everywhere I went, people are angry. And that anger can lead to some mischief. Because populism is not always constructive. It can be constructive, it can lead to reform. But it can sometimes, historically, both in the United States and abroad especially, it can lead to scapegoating. It can lead to some very, very ugly politics. And we can see that already. Now, my little sign says 20 minutes is up. So I had so many more interesting things to talk to you about. But I think hopefully the judge and your questions will allow me to get to them. Thank you so much.
Good evening. I'm Ladaris Cordell. I'm a retired state court judge, and I am thrilled to be here to interview Robert Reich. So thank you for being here. Before we talk about your book, Saving Capitalism, I'm curious about why you have set your goal in life, and these are your words, to fight the bullies, to protect the powerless, to make sure that the people without a voice have a voice. Why?
Well, I'm short. And I've always been short. When I was a little boy, I was very short. Even shorter than I am now. And what that meant, I mean, most of you were children. And you get, there's a bullying that happens because on the playground and when you're 2 and 3 and 4, there are no, it's not really civilization. Particularly when you're outside of the ambit of adults. So I got beat up, I got bullied, and I did get beat up. I discovered a way, a technique, actually two techniques for dealing with the bullies. One was to have arguments. So I became argumentative. I soon learned that even having good arguments didn't really have much effect. So I came up with another technique that had to do with power. I made alliances with older boys, you know, usually just 2 or 3, who would help me keep the bullies at bay, and I would summon my protectors when I needed them. It was the original protection racket.
It's a good system.
But actually, the end of the story is that, and this was actually a turning point for me, because in 1964, one of my protectors, whose name had been Michael Schwerner, when I was just going to college, he was older, he was considerably 6 years older, he had already graduated from college, he had gone to Mississippi to register voters, and he and two other civil rights workers were tortured and murdered in Philadelphia, Mississippi. And when I heard about his death by the real bullies, I mean, talk about bullies, I think that in retrospect, it was a turning point for me because I felt that I, out of not only memory and respect for him, but also given my background, it was very important to look out for the people who were powerless, voiceless, and who were basically not being recognized in society.
So I found, and maybe this is a shocker to you, I found your book, Saving Capitalism. Did you know it's a thriller? It's really a thriller, yeah.
It's a thriller.
So in the first 150 pages, you detail everything that is wrong with capitalism in America today. I found myself getting more and more agitated as I read about all of the injustices. And I kept wondering, how is this going to end? Where is he taking me? And then you take the final 36 pages of the book, and you talk about how it is that capitalism can be saved for the many. So I want to start with some of your solutions. You predict that a third political party, a countervailing power, will emerge if the Democratic and Republican parties don't cease their dependency on big business and Wall Street. So is the Tea Party one of those countervailing powers? And is that why the outsiders in both parties are doing well in the polls?
Well, I say in the book, and I wrote the book really before anybody had heard about Donald Trump or Ben Carson or Bernie Sanders or any of the so-called outsiders. But I say in the book that given the logical trajectory that we are going in, the big difference and tension in American politics in coming years will be less about Democrats versus Republicans and more about establishment versus anti-establishment. And that, and I think that the big choice before us is in future years is not going to be between liberals and conservatives. It will be between right-wing populism and left-wing populism. And I think right-wing populism, both of them are angry. Both of them take on the so-called ruling establishment. But I think right-wing populism does a lot of scapegoating, and it's very authoritarian. It's basically, follow me. I'm strong enough and big enough and powerful enough. And I think left-wing populism comes out of a much more reformist tradition, such as Teddy Roosevelt in the Progressive Era, such as the early Jacksonians in the 1830s.
Well, you also opine that the emergence of a new third party will not occur, in your words, smoothly or easily because, and once again from the book, the moneyed interests have too much at stake to passively allow countervailing power to reemerge. So are you saying that's going to be a revolution?
No, I don't think, we only did revolution once. I don't think we're going to do it again. I'm very optimistic because if you look back historically, what we do when capitalism gets off track is we put ideology aside, we roll up our sleeves, we get on with what has to be done. And I think the closest parallel to what we are seeing today is probably the period roughly between 1895 and 1903, where you had huge gap in income and wealth. You had urban squalor. You had corruption. You know, the robber barons, the lackeys who worked for the robber would literally take sacks of money and deposit them on the desks of pliant legislators. You had problems that were so visible to so many people, finally, that when you had an opportunity, when the country had an opportunity, and Teddy Roosevelt came along, he simply said, okay, he simply allowed it to happen. All of this progressive and populist impulse broke through, and the reformers they began their work. I mean, they didn't finish their work, at least that phase of it, until the 1930s.
The Supreme Court's conservative majority in the case of Citizens United, declaring that corporations are people too, has placed big money squarely in the campaign finance business. Now, I agree with you in your book where you write that Citizens United is a terrible decision. You write that the court must reverse itself. So how realistic is it that with the current composition of the court, do you think it will happen and happen in our lifetime?
Well, I don't know about our lifetime. Some people here in this audience are younger than others. But I think that, in my view, there are three Supreme Court cases that are probably the worst in history. One is Citizens United. The other is Dred Scott. The third is maybe Bush v. Gore. I don't know.
Plessy versus Ferguson.
Plessy versus Ferguson. There's some pretty bad ones, but of those four, two of them come from a contemporaneous Supreme Court. But remember, there are only it's a slim majority. I mean, Anthony Kennedy, on that Citizens United case, he just a few days ago gave an interview to the dean of Harvard Law School, Martha Minow, in which he said that one of the premises of that case was that we would have full disclosure of all sources of campaign finance, and that hasn't happened. And that has, he didn't say, but it certainly implied, he strongly implied, that has led him to at least not think harder about his decision. All you need is him to change his vote. I do not believe, generally speaking, that a president should have a litmus test for a Supreme Court nominee. But in the case of Citizens United, I think the next president should say, I am only going to nominate somebody who is absolutely pledged to reverse Citizens United.
I like that. So, let's talk drugs. Intellectual property is a huge moneymaker for the pharmaceutical industry because Congress has repeatedly changed the rules on patents. So you call the patenting of drugs temporary monopolies. How do we bust these monopolies, especially in light of pay-for-delay?
Well, what I try to do in the book, and the judge is pointing to one chapter where I look at property. I basically lay out in the first five or six chapters the building blocks of capitalism, of which property is one, contract is one, bankruptcy is one, market power, monopolies is one, and ask how over the last 35 years have those building blocks been altered, wittingly or unwittingly, by the compounding of great political power and wealth, big corporations and also Wall Street. And with regard to pharmaceuticals and patents, it's pretty clear that there has been a radical change in the law. For example, you point to the pay for delay.
Yes.
In most countries, and up until about 15 years ago in the United States, it was illegal for proprietary pharmaceutical companies to pay generic manufacturers to delay their introduction of generic versions of the proprietary drug when the patent was finished or exhausted. But in this country, over the last 15 years, it's now legal, and you have these proprietary companies essentially paying these generic companies to delay the introduction of generic drugs. That is costing us a lot of money. Estimates are about $3.5 billion a year, but it's very, very difficult to estimate exactly. But that's a kind of a redistribution upward from us, all of us, to the top executives and major shareholders of pharmaceutical companies. That's a decision that was made, but there was almost no public knowledge or public discussion about it.
So, when you say it's costing us, you're meaning that
consumers,
we're not able to get these pharmaceuticals at lower prices.
Yes, and there, in fact, there are a number of decisions that were made over the last 10 or 15 years. Some of us tried to get pharmaceuticals from Canada for a while because they were lower cost. That has been stopped. I remember when I was at the Federal Trade Commission, it was illegal for proprietary companies to advertise pharmaceuticals that could only be obtained by prescription, on the theory that why would you want to advertise it? Because it can only be by prescription. It's doctors that prescribe. Well, that ban was lifted, and we now know why. Because people are influenced. They go to a doctor and they say, I want you to prescribe that. Well, that also increases indirectly drug costs because it means that the physician is prescribing something that may not be exactly right, but it may be more expensive.
And that's the advertising, which is unique to this country.
Exactly.
So let's talk Silicon Valley. The rise in the power and the influence of the Silicon Valley tech industry, it's been rapid, it's been phenomenal, and I think in some instances very scary. So you note that Apple, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon have a platoon of lobbyists in Washington. And I just want to quote what your numbers here. In 2013, Apple spent $3.3 million on lobbying. Amazon, $3.4 million. Facebook, $6.4 million, Microsoft, $10.4 million, and Google, $15.8 million. Why do you believe that these companies should be reined in? So aren't these companies making life more convenient for all of us? Driverless cars, deliveries by drones, and their ability to connect all of us in the world in just a matter of seconds. So what's the problem?
Can I make it very clear? I love Silicon Valley. I love high technology. The only point I think that bears making along these lines is that when you have a monopoly over a network, that is a common platform or portal that everybody is using because everybody else is using. That needs to be scrutinized the same way any other monopoly needs to be scrutinized. It may be perfectly fine. It may be that the benefits way outweigh the costs, but it may also create market power that could be misused. And we used to have in this country a tradition of looking at all forms of monopoly power and at least, again, scrutinizing it, asking, do the benefits outweigh the costs?
You write that capitalism depends on trust. So if the system is so rigged against the have-nots, as you assert in your book, why do so many have-nots continue to vote for candidates who support this rigged system? Why do people who are struggling economically continue to vote against their own best interests?
Well, are you applauding because they're voting against their own best interests? I think it's a good question. I think part of the answer is that they have been convinced that their enemies, or the people who are really responsible for them not doing as well as they think they should be doing, are either immigrants or minorities, or they are foreigners, or they are some other group. That is, there's a kind of a politics of divisiveness that is going on. There are also social issues and cultural issues that are very divisive. And I think that people of the sort that I confronted in my tour over the last three weeks, many of them certainly are beginning to see that the game is rigged, or beginning to fear and feel that somehow there's some fundamentally unfair thing going on in terms of the organization of the political economy, but they still are nervous about these kinds of divisions, and it's not clear how they're going to vote. But I'll tell you something that I've noticed. The Republicans are, in this election cycle, talking more about inequality and talking more about a stacked deck or a rigged system than I have ever heard them before. Hillary Clinton, when she announced her candidacy several months ago, she announced it by saying that the deck is stacked in favor of those at the top. Now, I've never heard a major establishment candidate begin a campaign with those words. Her husband, I was there in 1992 when she and her husband launched their 1992 campaign. No way in the world Bill Clinton would have said anything of the sort. So what is happening is that even notwithstanding those cultural and social divisions that may trump,
so to speak,
the economic issues, still those economic issues are beginning to surface.
So let's talk about what people are worth. You write that there are people who work and who are poor, and that there are people who don't work who are rich, and that the non-working rich are viewed by so many of us being of more worth than the working poor. Why do the 46 million working poor in this country see themselves as worth only what they earn?
Well, that too, isn't it, is an interesting question. We do see the emergence. 30 or 40 years ago, we did not have a large group of people who were working full-time and poor. Most of the people in this country who were poor were not working. They were either thrown out of the labor force, they were unemployed, they were disabled, for whatever reason they were not working. And our entire system of welfare and our entire system of assistance was based and premised around the idea that these people could not work. But now we have a very large, of that 46 million, a large, large percentage of them are working full-time, many of them on two or three jobs, many of them more than 40 hours a week, and yet they're still poor. Now that signals to me that there's something misaligned, there's something wrong somewhere here. Now, we also have simultaneously the emergence of a larger, but nowhere near as large, but a growing group of people who have never worked, but they are wealthy by virtue of being from families, and they are heirs. That's not bad. I'm not blaming them, and I don't want to be heard to be blaming them. But both groups, the emergence of both groups, the working poor and the non-working rich, are antithetical to some extent to the kind of meritocratic ideal on which the nation is based, that you are, you know, people should work, they should be able to get ahead, everybody who works should be able to be out of poverty, and everybody who is able-bodied should be working.
Right. And another reason why people are so angry, working three or four jobs, but still can't find a way to make it.
Well, they're frustrated, and that frustration leads to anger. But they do internalize. You pointed to something a moment ago, Your Honor. May I call you Your Honor?
Oh, absolutely. I love it.
And that is also relatively new. When I interviewed somebody for a movie that I worked on a couple of years ago, a worker who was trying to decide whether to join a union, he said to me, and it's there in the movie, and it was very moving at the time to me, he said, I don't think I'm going to vote for a union because I don't think I'm worth any more than what I'm earning, about $11 an hour, because I don't have the brains. What was touching to me about that is that if he had lived and worked 30 or 40 years before, he would probably have been earning more, adjusted for inflation, or adjusted for a constant dollar, because he would have been a member of a union, and he would not have internalized personal blame by saying, well, I don't have a brain, and therefore I'm not worth that much.
Well, so let's change the pace a little, and let's do a saving capitalism lightning round.
A lightning round.
So I'd like you to grade, A to F, the following leaders on how effective they are or will be in saving capitalism for the many. All right.
Can I explain my vote,
sure,
my grading?
Sure, you can
my
explain
grading
your
system.
Grade. Yes. All right. Okay. Elizabeth Warren.
A minus.
All right.
Now, I think that... I think she's done a lot to help bring these issues to the fore, and she's very concerned about them, and she also is an activist in the best sense of that term. I don't give her an A because she chickened out from running for president.
Wow. Okay, next up, Donald Trump.
I think he earns a solid D, and I think the problem is that anybody who's running for president who blames whether it's Mexicans or Muslims or any other group and lets the people of this country wallow in that kind of blame, it legitimizes a certain hatefulness that is extremely dangerous. It's one thing if he wants to be Donald Trump and not run for president and blame Mexicans for pillaging and raping and doing all those things. But it is different. If you are in the public arena as a candidate for president of the United States, you don't say those kinds of things. You are really, you are demeaning the public, and you are actually inciting some very nasty politics.
Bernie Sanders.
Well, I'd give Bernie Sanders a B in terms of maybe a C plus in terms of effectiveness, but I give him an A in terms of truth telling. Now, the reason I'd give him a relatively lower grade for effectiveness is that I've learned over the years that people cannot hear if you don't speak to them in a language and in a way that invites them to hear. And so the use of the term socialist is so scary to a generation of people that grew up when we were fighting the Soviet Union, that's just unnecessary. I wish he wouldn't do that. and I think he could also lighten up a little bit.
Ted Cruz.
I think the audience speaks for itself.
All right. Hillary Clinton.
I'd give Hillary a B on kind of affecting and earning the public's trust. I think that she still appears to many people to be too close to the establishment, big money. People are worried about issues that continue to dog her. Why she didn't come out right away on those emails and just reveal everything and just do it in a very, very big and an obvious way, I don't understand. I'd give her an A minus on policies. I think her policies are quite good and her experience is extremely good.
Okay. President Obama.
I would give President Obama an A minus in terms of policies. I think the Affordable Care Act will go down historically as an extraordinarily important step. It's not where we ought to be. I mean, I think that we ought to be where most other advanced nations are, and that is with a single-payer system of healthcare. But I think given the deck that was dealt him in terms of his political opponents, and also the economy, I mean, we so quickly forget where the economy was when he entered office. I mean, we were on the edge of what could have been another Great Depression, and I think he deserves great credit for helping avoid that. Let me just say one other thing about Obama, because I've got to know him fairly well, not as well as I've known some other presidents, Bill Clinton, for example. I have never met somebody occupying the Oval Office or even near the Oval Office who is as even-tempered and whose ego is under such control. I mean, you know, most of the time, to run for president, you got to be, to some extent, a pathological narcissist. he is not. I mean, he really is normal, and he's very, very smart.
The U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, I'd give the five Republican appointees on the Supreme Court a failing grade. I really would. I think that they've done a great deal of damage. And we could, Your Honor, you know more than I do about the intricacies of some of their decisions, but not only the decisions we've talked about, but also the Shelby decision, I think, you know, which just ripped the guts out of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 for reasons that are, to me, and I've read that decision several times, incomprehensible.
I too am saddened. I look at, it's interesting, the law is interesting because it, for many years in this country, the Supreme Court decisions actually furthered oppression. And then with Brown v. Board of Education, 1954, things turned around. And then now we have this pushback, especially as you mentioned with the decision on the Voting Rights Act, almost, you know, gutting a major part of it. So it's interesting how the law has pushed us forward progressively and then pushed back. So. Hopefully, it will turn around again. Okay, switching gears here. You write, and this is from your book, in recent decades, the real decisions are more often hashed out behind closed doors in negotiations influenced disproportionately by giant corporations, big banks, and wealthy individuals. Their money buys lobbyists, campaign contributions, public relations campaigns, squadrons of experts and studies, armies of lawyers, and quiet promises of future jobs. And then you write, what I have described is not the same as corruption. Really? I mean, and it seems that you're giving these folks a pass. I mean, aren't closed-door deals that end up lining the pockets of the wealthy while putting the screws to the rest of us, isn't that corruption?
It certainly looks that way, but the point that I was trying to make in the book is that this is part of a political economic system, and it doesn't do much good to simply call certain people bad or to blame them. You know, lobbyists are doing a job that they are, some of them are very proud of doing. A lot of big companies and their CEOs tell me they have to do what they are doing, partly because their competitors are doing it, and if they don't do it and their competitors do, they're going to be at a competitive disadvantage. Or they tell me they have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders to do whatever they possibly can to influence legislation to the advantage of their companies. So what I want to do is provide my students and readers of my books and so on with a systemic view of a political economy that is going off the rails, not because anybody is particularly bad, but because as a system, it is no longer working as it should. There are many, many ways of reforming it, but unless we all understand it and not simply vilify, we are going to find ourselves without the capacity to create the kind of political alliances we need, but also make genuine reforms.
Since you and I are both recovering lawyers, I'm going to ask one legal question here. Charles Hamilton Houston was the first African American to be editor of the Harvard Law Review, and he became the dean of Howard Law School. And he was the mastermind of the legal strategy behind Brown versus Board of Education, and one of his students was Thurgood Marshall. So Mr. Houston died in 1950. Now, he always taught his Howard Law students this. He said, a lawyer's either a social engineer or a parasite on society. So you write about the platoons of corporate and bankruptcy lawyers who do all in their power to maintain the status quo of their client corporations. So in your view, are they parasites on society?
Well, if I've got to choose between those two, I don't really have to choose between the two. I think that Washington, and I've seen Washington over the past 40 years. My first job in Washington was in 1967 as an intern for Robert F. Kennedy when he was senator. And I've seen a lot of changes in Washington. I've gone in and out and in and out. My first full-time job in Washington was in the Ford administration, a Republican administration. Wow. And my first full-time boss in Washington was Robert Bork.
Oh my God.
I was assistant to the Solicitor General. Did you know that, Your Honor?
I did not know that.
Yes. Yes, and he and I, Robert Bork and I liked him a great deal. We disagreed, however, on the first, second, fourth, fifth, eighth, and ninth amendments to the Constitution. Which put something of a crimp in our working relationship, but what I meant to say is that the big change over the last 40 years has been the amount of money coming into Washington. When I started there working in 67, that summer of 67, Washington was kind of seedy. It was not a wealthy town. Only about 6% of retiring members of Congress went on to become lobbyists because there wasn't that much money in lobbying. You know, there weren't these fancy restaurants and bistros and hotels. It was not the Emerald City that it has become. It is now extraordinarily wealthy, and of the five counties surrounding Washington, three are among the wealthiest counties in the United States. And now 50% of retiring members of Congress become lobbyists, not because they are any less publicly interested or any less scrupulous than their predecessors, but because there's so much money now there. And I think that's the problem. The first thing we've got to do is get big money out of politics.
Not easily done.
No, but it's possible. That is, you probably remember the McCain-Feingold Act, which the Supreme Court in Citizens United basically found unconstitutional. Well, that McCain-Feingold Act, people said, no, you can't possibly limit campaign contributions. You'll never get the political support for it because everybody in Congress has a vested interest in the present system. But the McCain-Feingold Act was enacted and signed into law. You do get reforms. There are periods of reformist upsurge, and I think we'll see that again.
Before we take questions from the audience, and we have many already, could you just make a comment? I found your description in the book where you talk about property rights. You talked about airline seats. Could you tell us how that changed the whole concept of airline seats
well,
as
actually,
property?
Well, actually, I use that as an example of how the notion of property can be utilized in very positive and progressive ways, because there some people in this room remember when you could be bumped if there were too many people who were in an airline, and that was it. You were just bumped. You didn't have any rights at all. Well, so many people were upset about that, and Congress and then, I believe, did we still have a Civil Aeronautics Board? I think we did. That came up with a system, a kind of required system that essentially gave people a property right contractually in their seats, such that the only way that an airline could get rid of overbooked flights or overbooked passengers was to bribe them to give up their property right. That's why you have a kind of reverse auction. How many people will leave if we give you a free trip to Hawaii or a free glass of coffee or whatever it is? And that is how a property rights system can work for the benefit of the majority.
Wow, interesting. So we're going to go to questions now, and we have several of them. So I'm just going to kick right off here. And thank you all for submitting these questions. The New York Times recently did a series on the arbitration system, private arbitrators. And is the arbitration system as pernicious as it appears to be? And if so, what is to be done?
Arbitration and mediation are generally good things. That is, I think keeping a lot of disputes out of court, with all due respect, Your Honor, is a positive social development. I think the problem has to do with power. That is, if you have to, as an employee, a franchisee, a consumer, if you've got to sign a contract, you don't have any choice, that says any dispute will automatically go to an arbitrator, usually chosen by the company, then your rights to a trial are abrogated and your bargaining and negotiation power in that dispute is limited dramatically. And that's a good example of how contract law has been altered over the past 35 years.
So, indeed, when you talk about capitalism and saving it for the many, that's going to have to be addressed.
Yes,
right?
And in the book I do talk right. about that very issue.
Is Bernie Sanders really electable?
Is Bernie Sanders electable? It's interesting. If you go back to 2007, November of 2007, which is about the same time as we're in now, given a general election without an incumbent, Hillary Clinton was leading Barack Obama in most polls by almost exactly the same amount that Hillary Clinton is now leading Bernie Sanders.
What is going to
So that sort of answers
that,
your
that's, no,
yes.
That's fair. What is going to happen to the U.S. debt when interest rates go up?
Interest rates are going up, and although I would say the chances of the Fed effectively raising interest rates in December are about 85% probability right now. And by the way, economic forecasters exist to make astrologers look good. Nobody knows. But if interest rates go up, I think it's going to hurt the economy because I don't think the economy is nearly as robust as some of the data suggest. That is, unemployment is now down to 5%, and we had a very good month last month, but we still have millions of people, an inordinate, but much, much higher than normal at this point in a recovery, so-called, a number of people who are working part-time who would rather be working full-time. And we have a huge number. We have something in the order of 3 to 5 million people who are too discouraged even to look for work because they have not been able to find a job. Our labor participation rate, that is the percentage of people who are of working age who are actually in the workforce, is down to the lowest it has been still, the lowest it's been since 1978. And there's no sign of any inflation. Really, you can look anywhere under your bed. There's no inflation. I think it's a mistake for the Fed to do what it is going to do.
Why a national minimum wage of $15? New York, LA, San Francisco costs more than the central areas. Shouldn't wages be tiered?
I think there's a good argument. In fact, right now, we have a national minimum wage that is much lower than the minimum wage in most of your higher cost and higher living standard states. So states can still raise the minimum wage to whatever they want above the federal. But the federal minimum wage right now is $7.25. And that is historically very, very low. That's about 20% below what it was adjusted for inflation in 1968. If you just took the minimum wage in 1968 and you adjusted for inflation, it would be $10.60 today. And if you wanted to make a further adjustment, because the American workforce was not nearly as productive in 1968 as it is now, and I don't mean just high-wage workers. Even low-wage workers were not surrounded by nearly as much equipment. If you adjusted for productivity, you could make a good argument that the minimum wage ought to be about $12, $13 an hour, maybe higher, nationally. But I think that this is also a moral issue. It's not just an economic issue. I think that we should not have a country in which somebody is working full time and still in poverty.
Exactly. So we have time for one final question, and I do want to tell you that I think you are a national treasure. So thank you for all that you do. Truly. So our final question. Actually, it appears to be a compound question. At Dartmouth, it was rumored that you went on a date with then Hillary Rodham, the future Hillary Clinton, who was an undergraduate at Wellesley. Question, did you kiss and will you tell?
Well, here's the, in 2008, in the election 2008, I was called by a reporter for the New York Times who said, we've come across a collection of her letters from Wellesley. And in one of the letters, she mentions that she went on a date with you. And is there anything that you can tell me about that date that might shed light on how she would perform as a president? And first of all, I couldn't really remember the date, and I thought that would be bad form if I didn't remember the date. But I asked him a little bit about what the letter said, and it came back. And then I answered the question with my tongue firmly planted in my cheek. I said, well, we went out to a movie and she wanted an inordinate amount of butter on her popcorn. And then there was a long silence on the other. And I said, are you still there? I thought he might have hung up. And he said, I'm just writing this down. That's all I'm going to say.
That's enough. Thank you, Robert Reich.
Well, clearly you've all enjoyed tonight's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. We'd like to again thank Robert Reich, author of Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few, retired Judge Ladoris Cordell, our audience here in Campbell, and for those of you joining us on the web or the radio. This program tonight is now concluded. 100 years of enlightened discussion continues.